Body within the body, feelings within feeling, that is pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant, feeling tone, at all six senses. So bodily sensations, the senses, happy, unhappy, mind states. It's natural phenomena. It's part of who we are. So we're looking exactly at the immediacy of our experience, what's true. So the body sensations, felt experience, feelings, also true felt experience. Chitta, heart, mind, in all of its formations, expanded, contracted, anxious, concentrated, multitude of thoughts, and then all the way down to refined awareness of awareness that is tuning into the knowing mind itself. That is all other. What is known is in the background, and the knowing we come to know directly, anchored in that, and in knowing itself. And then finally, all other phenomena, all other psychophysical phenomena, and the senses, the sense fields. So then it's complete, our six sense door awareness. Looking at this experience is the second factor of awakening, Dhammavacchaya. That's the investigation of phenomena, investigation of physical, mental natures as they come up. A non-conceptual, direct feeling, sensing, investigation. So we're right away learning how to look, like what approach is helpful, what approach is hindering. So another way to describe it is that Dhammavacchaya not only means investigation of phenomena, but it's a wisdom. We're practicing wisdom. We're discerning what's skillful, what's unskillful, what path leads to further opening and refinement, insight and awakening, and what won't, what's counterproductive, what continues to build concepts of ourselves rather than reveal the nature of ourselves. We've spoken already pretty much at length of what constitutes unique nature, what constitutes universal nature. You know, so for example, understanding the textures of the body, smooth, hard, rough, grainy, silky, understanding that elemental nature, as well as the variations of heat, cool, cold, hot. And as you notice, we can't always control that. Even though the external temperature may be fairly constant, although here it's not so much, temperature can change because of cause and effect. So how we are looking at our experience, or what states we might be caught up in, or you know, just the coolness of mind at times, the effect that has on physical formations and other mind states. When we're angry, when we're confused, all those affect the variations of temperature. And one of the reasons why we emphasize a body-based awareness so much is that the body never lies. It can tell us often that there is an emotion before awareness really tunes into it. And to trust that, trust the body, because sometimes, as I've said, the particular mind state or emotion might be vague or confusing or disorienting even. But that's just the way it is. That's just the way that particular emotion is. So we don't need to work on making it any different. Study the sensations, investigate the sensations. If the sensations also reflect that vagueness or lack of clarity or a confusing or tight mass, then that's what it is. That's going to reflect the particular quality of emotion or mind state that you might be experiencing at that time. And likewise, the unique qualities of the mental states, emotions that arise. Again, it's not in our control. We come here and we just determine to be present. That's our only task, to be in the present moment. When I arrived at the Mahasi Center for a long period of practice as a monk, the first thing Saito Upandita said was, your only task is to be in the present moment. I'll take care of everything else. I just totally trusted him. And I was taken care of, fed and housed and clothed, you know, the robes are offered. No concerns. And really, that was the only task. It's very simple, extremely difficult to be in the present moment and sustain that present time awareness. So, but that's what we do, and then we start to recognize, and the practice itself reveals many variations of mental states and emotions, and they have all their unique natures. Some are sharp, hard, some are soft, gentle. Some seem to open the body, open the mind, lift us up, they're light, delightful. And some are oppressive, intense, contracting. They're just what they are, and our job is to notice them. Try to see them as a formation, like a mental sensation. Try to see their arising. If we don't see that, try to see their existence, momentary existence. And if we miss that, try to see their endings. And if we miss that, which we usually do, then recognize that we miss that. It's true. And if you ever use the labeling, it would be like forgetfulness. Or if you suddenly remember something that just happened, remembering. So we're not going back. We're still attuned to this very moment. But we're recognizing that mind was forgetful. When we do that in walking, that's really useful too. Take a few steps and realize that we have been gone a million miles away. And then, oh, okay, forgetfulness or remembering. You can back up, but you're not going to really back up in time. I took a few steps back once as if you could do that, but it's just always new. We never experience the same thing twice, ever. Not in the body, not in the eyes, not in emotional world. Nowhere at no time are any two moments the same. Any two sensations, any two thoughts, and sights, and sounds. It's always a fresh start in that sense. So in addition to that focusing in and feeling those fleeting, unique moments of body, mind, senses, visual, sound bites, etc., we start to, by now, at times at least, the awareness becomes more global and more broad and begins to feel the flow of everything. In fact, the particulars sometimes speed up so much, as we were talking, I think, yesterday, that they can't be discerned. No matter how hard we try to discern or investigate, that it's too busy or too fast or too much or too overwhelming. Sometimes we sit and we're not even sure what's a sensation, what's a sound, what's a thought. It's just broom, 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 you know, just phenomena coming and going, coming and going. That's when we sort of step back and open the heart wider and a more global mind awareness and feel the flow nature of everything. It's called anicca, the impermanent nature, that the whole universe is in constant flux. Nothing remains the same for two moments in a row. So, yes, sometimes we'll have that reflection, and it's not that it's not useful. We don't want to just keep reflecting. We actually want to feel that movement, that motion, that flow, that flux. We want to sense it in the body, even en masse, you know, like a whole river of body sensations. And the mind, just a stream, constant stream of mental states, thoughts, images, remembrances, consciousness itself, which is the most refined experience that we can attune to. Very, very quick mind moments of hardly aware. We can't catch one mind moment. It's impossible. It's already gone as soon as we see it anyway. Mostly we're just seeing, you know, the tail of the comet, so to speak. So we might as well just relax, right? We're never going to catch anything. It's all just falling over. It's like our awareness is this mist at the lip of a waterfall. The mist is created, of course, by the water itself. And we can sense, see, feel the approaching river. And then suddenly feel it drop away. And always this mist continues to change. This mist of mindfulness is itself continually changing. But it's as if it can, it's all part of what's coming, what's flowing, and what's vanishing into nothing. Just like that. So it's like our awareness is at the lip, the waterfall of experience all the time. And that mist, it's not in a hurry. It's renewed all the time. It's just there. It's relaxed. It's disappearing too, but then there's new little mist vapors. It's just, it's catching all of that. It gets a little scary at times, the speed with which things are changing. We have, it's not innate to our nature, but it's like this inherent like fear of annihilation. Because somewhere deep in our bones, we sense this change. We sense that there's nothing really there. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing solid. So this investigation also starts tuning in to these natures. Not only do they arise and pass, but exactly because they arise and pass so quickly, they are insecure. They are unstable. They are unreliable as any real sense of security. We have all kinds of strategies to have a temporary sense of security. You know, what's familiar to us are all our little collection of all of our little attachments that give us some sense of ourselves. Everything from, you know, our feral cats to our refrigerator to, you know, the pictures on the wall, our books, and we kind of look around, oh yeah, everything is kind of there, you know, so I must be here. We might not think quite like that, but you know, we'd be really confused if we walked into our place, so to speak, and it wasn't there. Well, that's what it's like to inhabit the body, inhabit emotions, inhabit our thoughts, because as we start to feel what they're really doing, you know, we want to grab onto something. And only as we start trusting this practice and really trusting our own wisdom inside, our Dhamma within, do we have begin to have moments where we feel secure. Why? Because we trust what's true. Ultimately, we want the truth. Even if it's painful, we want truth. That's our innate urge. Just as we long for love, to love and be loved, we also long for a liberating wisdom. So as painful as it can be at times, that's what keeps us going. And that's what keeps us kind of willing to risk the unknown and almost lose the sense of ourselves. The kinds of fear that can come up sometimes, definitely they're rooted in aversion, ill will, the unhealthy psychological root of hatred. But at this point of practice, the kind of fear that we might be feeling is what Mahasi Sayadaw called a Dhamma fear, a healthy fear. It's like the other night I was talking about healthy sorrow, healthy grief, because we're seeing the truth. And the truth isn't particularly comfortable. You know, it doesn't, at first it's not that great a news, you know? It's like Michelle quoted the late Tibetan teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, I think last night. And let's see if I can remember one of his quotes too. He said, I think he said something like, "We're all falling. We're all free falling. Nothing to hold on to, no parachute. But then we realize there's no ground." That's the truth. We need a lot of courage, and that's the next bojanga, the wirya bojanga, courageous energy, the quality of awakening. Courage and balanced effort, courageous energy and effort. We had it to begin with to some degree, or we wouldn't be here. And it's what helps us sustain, what's helped us establish the kind of limitations and reduced circumstances that create a safe boundary, a safe container. You know, we all give up a little bit, we're all renunciates here. We're all nuns and monks when we're on retreat. And that's how we start to feel safe. We're trying to create a peaceful awake and energy for the sake of ourselves and everyone else here. So to do that, to be willing to surrender to those reduced circumstances and limitations, you know, even though, sure, we want to break out of them at times, but we start. That's how we start to feel protected and start to trust the Dhamma. And this courage comes up, this wirya, this incredible good energy that's powerfully liberating. It can't be used destructively. So as long as it's wirya, we're not going to strive or overstrive or drive or, you know, try and nail the moment. And we're not going to lean too far away either. That when the virya is up, it's working just to meet each moment as it is, not striving, not driven, not goal-oriented, and also try not to miss too much. You know, keep coming back to center. When we bend too far forward, we tighten, we push, we catch that. It's not the virya. Investigation catches that, brings it back. It allows us then to fully face what's happening. Well, no matter what goes on, you know, yeah, sometimes it's too much and we need to resource somehow. We need to look at light, we need an interview, we just need a nature walk, we need to be by the sea. All the ways that we resource, the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, and so forth, caring, calling up that caring. When we can, we It's like turning our body completely. It's said that elephants do that when attention calls them. They completely turn their bodies to face what it is, a sound or a scent or an intuition, to face that. It said that in the text, it said that elephants and arahants do that. Arahants are fully enlightened beings. But it's also true that very mindful yogis do that. I first noticed that Upandita always did that. I walk into his cottage and, you know, you make a type sound when you approach a monk. You don't knock on the door and say, "Hi, I'm here, can I come in?" You're quiet, but then you make some sound to make it known you're around, and then you go in. If it's not appropriate, you'll get that signal somehow. But when Sayadaw would hear that, he may be looking at a book or, you know, face in another direction, he wouldn't turn his head. He'd turn his whole body. That fully facing presence is exactly what we're learning to do with this courageous energy. To fully face when we can, when we have the strength, and when we feel protected by the reduced circumstances and limitation, and feel what's there. If not, we're more liable to try and think it into understanding, or think it away, or think it into repression. And thinking is always separating. You know, thinking is useful at times, especially wise reflection, but thinking as a constant and continuous way of not fully facing experience is a way to keep that experience constantly at bay. Whereas this feeling awareness unites. It brings awareness or investigative awareness with this courageous energy face to face with whatever's going on. Feel that pain, feel that grief, feel that sorrow, feel that loneliness, just as it is. We're only asking of ourselves a few mind moments at a time. Then if we have to turn, we do. We can turn away and face something else. And if we really need to, we can shut down. But as we find safe resources, you know, how to be mindful of something neutral like sky, blue, moon, loving kindness, and so forth, we don't have to shut down. We just go anchor in that resource. Then when we're able to, we return to that Dhamma pain or karmic knot of grief, of loneliness, fear, insecurity, anxiety. This is our work. And also, sometimes it can feel overwhelming to be with joy. That's the next quality of awakening. Piti. Piti is essential for our practice to lift the body, lift the mind, saturate ourselves in the pleasant feeling, take further steps on the path. We can't do it without this non-sensual joy. But it can be really amped up at times. It can be too much. And we fully facing it at that time may not work so well. It's like the electricity keeps going up and up. So we need to at least recognize that it's there and begin to learn how to call up the rest of the awakening factors like calm, concentration, and equanimity. When if the investigation is out of balance, it becomes intellectual and we're trying to keep reflecting and making some conceptual sense of our experience. And also, without the calm, concentration, equanimity, energy is going to be misused. we're going to, you know, we usually err on the side of pushing too hard. So we try to encourage our students to relax and lean back in the moment, ease up, soften. Really gentle, but kind approach to practice. Affectionate awareness, compassionate awareness, joyous awareness. Because we're liable to push more likely that than slack off. So here's where they all come into balance, and mindfulness is regulating them all. Mindfulness is helping bring up the necessary tranquility when we're amped up too much. The energy's too high, and our the joy factor, you know, might be clinging to it or just overwhelmed by it. We can't help it. It's part of how the practice unfolds. And we reach that place within where it's just released. It's a quality we already have, and maybe we're undernourished. Most of us are undernourished with this piti. So it does sense, it's like trying to drink water from a fire hose. You know, just get blasted at times. The piti helps lighten up the space so we can carefully dismantle some of our inner constructions. You know, the construction we have about ourselves, most importantly, but also the construction we quickly build about others, about life, you know, the judgments, the ideas, the fears, the desires. All the melodramas. So with this, the spaciousness that joy starts to bring, and you know how it lightens up the field, then that mindful curiosity, investigation, can dismantle the density of our story. See the level of story making going on. It's so habitual. Some of our stories are ancient, you know, they're decades old, and we just can't help it. We look, we see, we don't catch the space. There's plenty of space between looking and seeing and moments of seeing, but it's as if there's no moments, it's as if there's no space. We immediately are judging. Immediately the form comes. If we recognize it, then it's usually a judgment from familiarity, like, dislike, neutrality. If we don't recognize the form of the person, the object in nature, we're still going to judge it. We'll come up with something new. Well, that's that, and compared to this and that, and assess, analyze that kind of construction, that kind of story making. It takes a while to feel that lightness of being that comes from piti, from delight, happiness, joy. To see the story kind of as it is, not believe it, and begins to unravel, dismantle itself in the mere observation of it. So then we start to see the various components, the emotional, mental state components. Maybe it's restlessness, maybe it's anxiety, maybe it's sadness, maybe it's longing. But that's gonna color the story. That's one of the hidden mind states that often keeps feeding a very familiar, sometimes obsessive story. But then now we're just able to start to separate those mind states and those emotions from the story and anchor them where? Anchor them in the sensations that never lie, that reflect that sadness, that longing, that judgment. You know, judgment usually is either to do with longing or anger. The body will tell us. We don't have to be searching. We don't have to even start asking ourselves, is it this or is it that? Just feel the body. If there's going to be clarity about the mental state or emotion, let it come in its own time. Just feel body sensations. and then the feeling tone. Often if it's a story with wanting and longing, might be pleasant, at least at first. And if it's not, if it's one of judgment and fear, projection, then the response, the sensations and the mind state, unpleasant, unhappy. So like unpleasant, in unpleasant sensations, it's the same unhappy mind state. It's not yet a reaction. The reaction is aversion. Unhappy, unpleasant, it's just a response to life as it is. Pleasant, happy, it's just the response to life as it is. It's not yet craving, clinging, attachment. So just regard that, because sometimes the happy feeling feels a little more accurate than pleasant. You hear it, pleasant, too much. You get sick of it, you know? You can use the Pali, sukha. Sukha vedana. Pleasant feeling, happy feeling. Sukha means happy. Dukkha vedana. Unhappy. Unhappy feeling. Unhappy sensation. Unpleasant. Upeka. Upeka. Neutral. Vedana. Upeka. Neutral feeling tone. Impartial feeling tone. Neither pleasant or unpleasant. Neither happy or unhappy. That's how we start to unpack our dramas, our narratives. You know, we'll carry them around. Some of them we'll always have to some degree. But with the joyousness, it lightens things up, and it's like we start to befriend the various component parts that make up these stories, and it just gets harder and harder to be hooked by them, to believe them. They then become just stories. Just imagination, just fantasy. And we have to check out. Then we have to really check out, well, is this real? Is this true? And that's the investigation that knows whether something's skillful or unskillful. And then one of the jobs of courageous energy is to decrease or release unskillful states, unhealthy states that have already arisen, that are already habitual in the heart, and to prevent unskillful states that have not yet arisen, that are not yet a habit, from arising. So courageous energy just does that. It's part of its job. We don't have to know about it even. So it's just such a good energy. That's the effect of it. And two more. Courageous energy sustains skillful states, healthy mental states, healthy emotions. And it nurtures and cultivates, develops healthy states and emotions that have not yet arisen, that are not yet part of our habitual way of being in a good way, habit in a good way. In that way, it's like we just replace the kind of stories that tangle us up all the time, that make us unhappy, that make us sad. It's kind of like a carpenter who replaces an old peg with a new one. You know, maybe a slim wooden peg, and pounds it in to a big, thick, old one, rotten one, and pushes it out. So it's really healthy to do that and see, okay, well, it's not such a great thinking pattern. A lot of weightiness there, negativity there, you know, feeling of imminent disaster, catastrophe. May I replace those? May I replace it at least with something neutral? But even better, may I get some positive thoughts in there? And how do I nurture some healthy emotions? Okay, and that's one of the reasons why joy is the joy, the happiness of piti is so important in our stages of awakening, insight, growth. We feel it physically and we feel it mentally. The piti lifts everything up. So, you know, it's at different levels. And I said at the last retreat that an initial kind of piti is called minor piti. And it's like when the hair feels like it's standing up on our neck or our head, you know, little tingly sensations. Not so intense, it's like hardly know that it's there. The second one, we know it a little more. It's called momentary. It's more like a flash of lightning. You know, that's pretty effective at night when we see lightning. That light just enters our body and enters our mind. Kaboom, like that. So piti has that, the second kind of piti has that effect. Fills us up momentarily. Get charged, like a little bit of electricity goes through us. And the third, showering. Well, that's a little more immersion. Like this Japanese bathhouse we used to stop at on the way to Burma when we had 6 to 8 hour layover in Tokyo. Take the train in, go to the bathhouse, and you know, all these tubs of water. Some of them had tea, and they looked like tea anyway. Some are really, really hot, and some are really, really cold. Sometimes you go in a room and you roll around in salt, and then you walk through this thing and get showered off, and then you can go outside and stand under these bamboo spouts that pour warm water all over your body. It's like showering piti. Now, those last two, momentary and showering, they're not always pleasant. Because it is like a flash of like lightning, or because it is a jolt of electricity, very much like that. Sometimes it's like those involuntary jolts that we feel in the body, jerk, movement, and sudden cramping, and strange phenomena going on in the body that is at least annoying, sometimes outright painful. We've had yogis literally pushed across the room. We couldn't even have them in the hall. One of Michelle's yogis, like, it's unbelievable. Like, that energy just completely would displace the space he was in, put him somewhere else. He didn't like it. It wasn't very pleasant. So he'd walk about 12 miles a day to another town in New England. It's like the Dhamma working out this purification process on a profoundly physical level. So it started happening to me in one of the long retreats with Sayadaw Upandita, and I luckily practicing in my room. My body went through these strangest contortions that I don't think any yoga posture can possibly put you in for 9 hours. It was all over the floor, and my arms and legs and my mouth and face. I mean, if someone walked in at that time, it would have been horrifying, I'm sure, to both of us. But that's what happened, you know. It's just like this, Sayadaw would call it Dhamma massage. Now, sometimes massage feels really good, and sometimes, you know, if you ever had the shiatsu or the elbow one, Rolfing, it's ungodly painful, you know. So that's to understand that all the things that go on in the body, even if they're called piti, there's a mistaken view that it's necessarily pleasant. It's not. Until the last one. The fourth one is uplifting. Body feels light, feels like clouds. It feels literally like it's lifting up. And it said, I don't know, it said that the psychic power of elevation or levitation comes with that PT. But at least, I don't know if it's true or not, but at least sometimes it feels that way. And yogis open their eyes to see if they're off the ground, you know. So light, so, and it's serving its purpose here, the lifting up of the emotions, the lightening of the body, so we don't have such a constricted sense of ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally. And then finally, the most mature or developed PT is all suffusing. So it's lost its rapture, it's lost its ecstatic edge, and it certainly has lost the painful aspects that PT can have on us. And now it's just this smooth flow. It's still PT, but it's now completed the task, and it's completed the task and integrated the previous energizing enlightenment factors. Investigation or discernment, courageous energy, and piti now converge, and they come together. These are the qualities that energize. And we call these up when there's too much calm or tranquility or absorption. We're not seeing things as they really are because the mind's too absorbed. And it's either it can go sleepy or what we call sinking mind. It's deeply absorbed, it's not sleepy, but it's not seeing clearly. You know, or it can get really attached to peaceful, calm states. So that's when we call up one or more of the energizing states. We can literally call them up. You know, like may piti arise, may delight arise, or happiness arise, whichever word fits for you. It's just that particular aspect and quality of the awakening factor that opens the heart and brings this delight and even awe and reverence for this practice. It's often like when every breath we can tell we've never breathed before. Points in practice where it feels like that's the first breath I've ever had. It's just another breath, but it's not another breath. It's that breath, every breath we take, there's been none like it before. So it's only our habit of familiarity. Oh, well, I always breathe like that, or, you know, it's just the same old breath. It's never the same old breath. And the combination, the convergence of investigation or discernment, courageous energy, and the delight, the spiritual pleasure, the joy of piti, at least for moments, see anew. Like seeing a flower as if for the first time. Which when my mom was really old, we couldn't tell at times whether it was just her, you know, innocence. As she grew older and older, let's say we became the parent. She became the child. But we didn't know when it was that innocence or when it was delight. But I've always brought her flowers. She loves flowers. I bring flowers from the florist or from our garden or from her garden. And she'd be in there and she'd see that flower. And, oh, how beautiful. And you could tell, it was like she had never seen such a thing so beautiful in all her life. So that kind of freshness or innocence, this is what PT and other states do. Walking is really helpful to integrate all of these qualities because the kind of energy we get from sitting is one kind. It's a certain intention, right? Chaitana means intention or volition. So it's intention to sit up, sit straight. Not rigid, but sit straight. And just doing that will bring energy. In fact, the Buddha said, energy indeed, which I cultivated and made much of to reach supreme and full awakening. That was his teaching. And then, having said this, he sat up with straight body and mindfulness established. Like, he turned himself on, right? So sometimes we just think about energy and maybe we'll sit up a little straighter and bring in that freshness, bring in that newness. So good is this, is that courageous energy. So transformative and so supportive. So walking is a different intention. Walking is movement. It's meditation in motion. It's concentration in motion. It's more of a fluid concentration. Because we're focusing, our anchor, our intention is still mindfulness, but our anchor is on moving sensations. And doing that, it's like that the practice of non-congealing. You know, I mentioned the other night, we're continually bringing this fluidity, this nimbleness, this flexibility to our practice. So that the energy that accompanies, that it takes to sustain that kind of fluid focus brings something that no other posture can. And so does standing, if you recall. I forget which retreat, but one of the, either last week or this week, when I gave the instructions, at least half of us stood up. And that's a different energy. That's a different intention, the intention to stand. And therefore, due to that intention and due to that posture, it's a different energy and balancing and concentration. But the most sort of radical meditation posture, energy-wise, is the walking. Because standing, sitting, and lying down are all relatively, do not require that particular combination of energy and fluidity and focus. So keep that in mind. I was more prone to sitting. I had this idea, this misconception that it's mostly about sitting for long periods of time. And my teacher asked if I would just give it 2 weeks. And if I didn't connect with it in 2 weeks, then I could do what I wanted. Obviously, he knew it would grab me. I did. I gave it 2 weeks, you know, followed the schedule, or if I sat longer, I walked longer. And I felt that energy. I was paid attention at the end of the walking, the kind of and quality of energy and concentration that came from the end of that walking and accompanied me kind of moment to moment, or influencing the moment to moment like a following sea back to sitting, really changed my whole practice, really added a whole different dimension. And once he felt I understood, he said two things. He said, you should walk until you feel like a total stranger to yourself. It's the same innocence as my mom with the flower. It's the same innocence as when we feel that we've taken the first breath we've ever taken. When we get so mindful that taking a breath is like inhaling the nectar of the goddesses. Walking until it's just the absence of any previous conceptual formulation of who we are. And then the other thing he said, maybe not at the same time, he said, before we do something like walking, you know you're about to lift. The intention, the chaitana, is there, which is something that's good to be mindful of. It teaches us a lot about the cause-effect impersonal nature of ourselves, of everything. You feel the intention of that you're about to lift, but you never know what's going to happen. It's always a complete mystery. So I kind of learned to apply that to as much as I could to all parts of my practice. Every time I walked, or every time I sat, every time I felt forgetful or creating stories in my mind, just think of that. You really don't know what the next breath is going to feel like, what it's going to be like. It's always a mystery. And it just starts to create that mystery of things. It's, you know, one of the ways to sustain piti, delight, spiritual happiness, joy, is sometimes it's just to consider the big picture of things. For example, the Buddha once said, as far as those suns and moons revolve, shedding their light in space, so far extends the thousand-fold world system. In it are 1,000 suns and 1,000 moons, thousands of earths, and thousands of celestial worlds. This is said to be the thousand-fold minor world system. There are millions of middling world systems. There are millions of major world systems, all in expansion or contraction process. That kind of stuff really turns me on, you know, like cosmologies. And so I modern astrophysics too keeps me really always glued. It's a better news. It's a better news feed, believe me. During the Shakespearean drama last fall, some professor at the University of Nottingham in England suddenly discovered that our universe is 10 times larger than we thought it was. We thought it was 200 billion, you know, bodies of light, right? Suns or systems. Well, the professor discovered that it's 2 trillion. So, I mean, those numbers can't even compute, right? They just don't compute. It just makes our blue-green jewel in our little solar system, you know, in some corner of one of the smaller galaxies. And our breath, our every breath, all of them are precious. In the Buddhist teaching of how important this human life is, as Michelle was saying, there's so many other life forms we could take. But we came as humans, where we get just enough dukkha, just enough sukha, that maybe, if we're fortunate, we're motivated to make the best, to try to find some way in. How do we use this short, precious life? And whatever time we're given, how do we best use it? Definitely being kind, you know? And definitely trying to know as much as we can of how we can be kinder. And whatever else might happen that's illuminating, uplifting, connecting, liberating.
Planning solar systems.
Yeah, planning. So I'll finish with pasiri is that soothing, calm, ease, bodily ease, emotional ease, pasiri. And then samadhi is the non-distracted mind, starts to come together in this body-mind unification, stillness, contentment, and profound insight from this vipassana concentration. And then upekkha, that shining, sublime emotion of equanimity, balance. But I'll end with something. It's a simple but profound poem, and I think of all of us, I think, how did we get here? How did we all get here? We could have been somewhere else or someone else. That's what I get from Billy Collins. I go back to the house for a book. I turn around on the gravel and go back to the house for a book. Something to read at the doctor's office. And while I am inside, running the finger of inquisition along a shelf, another me that did not bother to go back to the house for a book heads out on his own, rolls down the driveway, and swings left toward town. A ghost in his ghost car, another knot in the string of time, a good 3 minutes ahead of me, a spacing that will now continue for the rest of my life. Sometimes I think I see him. A few people in front of me on a line are getting up from a table to leave the restaurant just before I do, slipping into his coat on the way out the door. But there is no catching him, no way to slow him down and put us back in sync. Unless one day he decides to go back to the house for something. But I cannot imagine for the life of me what that might be. He is out there, always before me, blazing my trail, invisible scout, hound that pulls me along, shade I am doomed to follow, my perfect double, only bumped an inch into the future, and not nearly as well versed as I in the love poems of Ovid, I who went back to the house that fateful winter morning and got the book. Let's just sit for a moment with our fatefulness.